Joy. Joy is the strength to enter the battle, not the victory itself. This is a quote from Chris Stefanik, who is a Catholic speaker and apologist who has a lot of videos online and different books and programs. Joy is the strength to enter the battle, not the victory itself. He shared this quote in a presentation he gave to a group of vocation directors as we were gathered for a conference. And I have to admit, it's like the only thing I remember from his talk to us. But I found it as a very powerful and profound statement. Joy is the strength to enter the battle. It's not the victory itself. And I think it hit me because so oftentimes I think of joy and happiness as the reward of something. The reward of a victory, or once everything is finally at peace, then we can experience joy. Or it's somehow the result of having everything perfect and put together. And then joy is possible. But the reality that he's posing is actually that, no, joy is in the midst of what we experience. Joy is not the fruit of something and just the result of having it all together. But joy is an actual reality that comes from a relationship. He has written a book on joy, and I haven't read the book, but within kind of looking at what it's about, it seems like Chris Stefanik's main point in it is that so oftentimes we think of joy being something when all the externals around us are in place, that everything around us has to change to make joy possible. Whereas in reality, joy is our hearts changing. And that's a really important thing, I think, for us to sit with as we're in our third week of Advent. We're at this halfway point, Gaudete Sunday. Gaudete coming from the word rejoice. So this is a week where we light that rose-colored candle, the week where we focus on rejoicing. The idea of rejoice coming from our opening antiphon, rejoice always, and again I say rejoice. That verse that's taken from Paul's letter to the Philippians, which we heard in this cycle, we heard it in our second reading. And so the liturgical color then of today is this rose color, quite literally because of the image of as we've been in darkness and the sun begins to rise, which we can see in our image, there's this pink, this rose color that comes in the midst of the violet, of the purple, of this regular penitential season. And so today, as we look at rejoicing, as we look at joy, for us to take a step back and acknowledge that it's not something that is the result or promised at the end, but there is something about joy that is immediate. There's something about rejoicing that transforms where we are right now. We hear in the scriptures the combination of rejoicing and he who is to come. It didn't say wait and rejoice when the Messiah does come. Joy is already present in what we heard proclaimed in our readings today. The first three readings in this cycle, in cycle C that we find ourselves in, are very clearly about joy. I think if you heard that first reading, the psalm, or the second reading, and then someone were to say, what was the theme of the third week of Advent? I think we would all be able to say, rejoicing. It said rejoice, it said joy, all throughout those first three readings. The gospel, not so much. The gospel actually has that apocalyptic language again. This idea of the Messiah coming with fire and burning away things. And that doesn't seem as joyful, honestly. But I think what actually is brought out in our gospel is the beauty and the steps that we take to allow joy to be present right now in our lives. If joy is not about changing this out here, our circumstances, but it's about changing our hearts, if the whole idea of Advent is preparing our hearts and making those changes that allow us to receive the Messiah, the Christ, well, then actually our gospel presents very, very clearly some very simple ways to do that. We have three groups in our gospel that approach John the Baptist. that come to him to be baptized, and they ask the question, what should we do? What do we need to do? What should we be doing? And they ask this of John the Baptist, and they're moved to this question because of a joyful expectation. They're starting to feel in their hearts, it's happening. What has been promised is coming to be. We can tell. So we need to change something to prepare for the Messiah. And so first we have the crowds who come. You know, these are the people that are already expecting. They're ready. They've been living their lives according to the law and the commandment, the relationship with their God. And so as the signs are coming that the Messiah is almost here, they're ready. All right, what do we do? What do we need to do, John the Baptist? Tell us. And very simply, he says, charity. If you have, give to those in need. You don't need to do anything huge. You don't need to change necessarily all these things around you. All you need to do is, quite frankly, look right around you and who is in need. And then be charitable. Give to those who are in need around you. That's it. That's a pretty simple step, actually, when we think about it. Sometimes we're afraid to ask the question, what should I do, Lord? And the idea of what the Lord may respond and want us to do scares us from even asking the question. Oh my gosh, what if he asked me to be a missionary in another country? What if he asked me to leave everything I have for him? What if he asked me to give everything I own and possess and hold on to give it up? I don't want to do that. But we see here very simply, when the question, what should I do, is asked, it's a very simple, small little thing. Charity. Love those around you. The other two groups are more specific. It identifies two different groups that come. We have the soldiers who come and ask, they're moved with that same expectation and ask, what do we do? What should we do as soldiers? Now, the word soldier that's used in this gospel, in this context, isn't the more common one that's used in the gospels referring to the Roman soldiers, but is a less used one that historians and biblical scholars think are probably soldiers of maybe Herod or within the Jewish people themselves, perhaps soldiers of the high priest. So they would be familiar with the coming of the Messiah and kind of what would be pointing towards that. But we can see from what John tells them that perhaps they were kind of abusing their authority in the positions that they were serving in. They were not practicing a charity towards those who they were put in authority over. And so what does John say? He doesn't tell them to stop being soldiers. He doesn't tell them to change the externals. He says, within what you're doing, be holy. Within this way of life that you're living as soldiers, love better. Be holy within this state of life you found yourself, that you have said yes to. So don't practice extortion. Don't falsely accuse people. And be honest in your work. And so this brings us to that third group, which is actually the second group, but I saved it last because honestly, they're the most scandalous of all the groups, the tax collectors. I think we know the reputation of tax collectors. We see within the Gospels that like anytime Jesus interacts with the tax collectors, the Pharisees lose their minds. They're like, this is so scandalous that you're even talking to a tax collector. And part of the reason of that, if we think about it, tax collectors were people, Jewish people, who work then for Rome, collecting taxes. And honestly, most of them did so in a way that kind of took advantage of their own people. They would collect more than was actually needed for the taxes. And so what we see is that taxes aren't necessarily bad, but the abuse of that authority, taking more than what was prescribed, well, that's what really made the people upset. To the point where this issue that is political really became spiritual. If you read some of the writings of the Jewish people, kind of the laws that they lived by around that time, to come in contact with a tax collector made you unclean. These tax collectors were seen as betrayers, backstabbers, evil people. And so all of a sudden it became within the law of life that if you shook hands with them, if you brushed up against them in the marketplace, your house was rendered unclean. And you had to be purified before you could enter into worship again. We're talking some low life level stuff here. And yet, even these people, the tax collectors who were treated in that way, who were seen as unclean, they were moved with a joyful expectation of what the Messiah may mean, what the coming of the Christ may mean for them as well. They recognized and represent the reality that the promise of the Messiah is universal for all people. And they too allow their hearts to be moved. And they ask, what do we do? What do we need to do to prepare our hearts? And again, John doesn't tell them, well, stop your dirty way of life, you tax collector. Do something else. Become a prophet. Become a missionary. No, he says, within what you're doing, be holy. Love well. Stop abusing your power. Live with charity within the context you find yourself living. Because it's not about us changing what's out here. It's about us changing what's inside of us. It's about us allowing our heart to be transformed, to love well. The reestablishing of this relationship, the justice that is required to enter into a life that is holy, a reestablishing of desiring the good of another above self, is an important piece of the coming of Messiah. As he comes and he establishes and promises a justice where the wrong is made right, where those in need are provided for. When we hear this promise, the promise starts with our hearts. I'm reminded of a second quote. So this is a two-quote homily. So the first one about joy from Chris Stefanik. This second one, St. Teresa of Calcutta, Mother Teresa. Someone we see who really lived a life of small acts of kindness. She understood that the question really is simple. What should I do? When I get up each morning to ask that question of God, today, what should I do? What does it look like to live as you want me and to do what you want me to do today? So we see that example in her life, and she was asked one time, you know, we recognize, again, recognizing that she was constantly saying small things with great love. She was saying it and she was showing it. And someone asked her, what do I need to do to change the world? Recognizing the impact that she had on our entire globe. And she responded, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. So simple. If you want to change the world, start here first. Start with your relationships that are given to you and love well. Let there be justice instead of injustice in the people around you. Where there is need, give. If you want to change the world, go home and love your family. St. Teresa of Calcutta recognized so clearly that this is our vocation as a Christian people. First and foremost, before we live out any details or particular realities, our vocation, our call is to be holy, is to desire the good of others above ourselves. This is the pattern. This is the way that joy becomes a reality in our life. And we rejoice that we're able to enter into that work of justice, of seeing need and giving, of desiring the good of another above myself. This is the pattern of Advent. And so I think for us, we are at the midway point of Advent. We have 2 weeks left. For perhaps something for us to start today is asking throughout each day of Advent this question that the gospel provides for us. What should we do? It's an example. It's a question, I think, that is given to us as an example from Mother Teresa. It's given to us by John the Baptist. It's given to us by tax collectors. for us to humbly ask within our hearts, God, what should I do? So that we can recognize and rejoice in a joy lived out in the transformation of our heart. Not something we're waiting to eventually enjoy, but a reality that we are living now each day as we seek the answer to that question, to live out and allow our heart to be transformed by the prayer, the request, the question, Lord, what should I do?